So I was on call overnight and I got a call from the nurses who said, we've got a patient. His name is Robert. He came in with chest pains and shortness of breath, and we've run every test and his heart is fine, but he does not want to go home. He seems very anxious. He says there's unresolved things and he's very worried. And the nurses basically said to me, there's nothing medically that we can do. I think he needs you. And I was like, well, no pressure there. I am just logistically, I identify as a woman. My pronouns are she and hers, although I'm comfortable with they and them. I am a mother. I am a wife. I am a lesbian. I am a minister. I am a Unitarian Universalist. I am a pet owner of 2 dogs and 4 cats. I am an unapologetic progressive liberal. I am a lover of nature and hopefully, I like to think of myself as a champion for social justice and equity in the world. I think my parents, I call myself a Protestant mutt because my parents liked church, but they weren't attached to any particular denomination. So I say that I was baptized Episcopalian. I was confirmed United Methodist. We lived overseas for a while and we became members of the Anglican Church because that was the only church that was allowed in Spain. I went to a Lutheran college. And my mom made the joke once that we went to whatever church had the best youth program. And like that just was okay. So I don't, and my family wasn't really religious, but I always liked church. But for me, the most religious experience and the one that really defined my theology was the YMCA camp that I went to as a kid, starting when I was 6. And the epitome of church for me was chapel in the trees, you know, sitting at morning chapel around in a circle or sitting in the chapel at camp, singing songs, sharing about kindness and basic decency on a level that kids could understand. And still, when I think about theology and life and church, that church in the woods is the closest that I've ever gotten to that ideal as far as community, connection with the divine, and working with people to create really magical experiences. So camp was it. We also, my family were big campers. So that's what we did all summer. As soon as school was out, my mom would pack us up in the pop-up. We would go across to Michigan where my grandparents were, and we camped all summer. So living in a tent in the trees, you know, that's always where my most spiritual, at home, relaxed moments were. And even now, you know, I get one Sunday a month off as a minister, and every single one is spent camping. Like that's what fills my spirit, what fills my soul and my theology. My personal theology, I'm a Unitarian Universalist, but my personal theology is very earth-based. You know, it's goddess, female, it's Mother Nature, Gaia, the energy that changes the seasons, that fills us with oxygen, gives us water and nutrients on all the metaphorical levels. So it's always been about nature. And it was really my mom. I mean, my mom was big on camping and family and all of that, and was modeling strong female power, even if I don't think she would have named it that way, but she was.
She was a goddess.
She was a goddess. And she was creating, you know, magical spaces for us to discover our own goddess power, if you will. Understand the story, you got to have a little bit of context for it. And there's two huge pieces of context. One is, as part of the process to become a Unitarian Universalist minister, I had to do a semester of chaplaincy training. And for me, it was in a hospital where I chose to do it where I lived, which was in Orlando, Florida. And the only hospital program that had the training chaplaincy was a Seventh-day Adventist program because it was a Seventh-day Adventist hospital. So you, first of all, just kind of say, if I wanted to stay home, which I did, I had to, as a female minister, was going into a very, and a progressive liberal religion was going into a very conservative hospital system where the chaplains, paid chaplains, were all Seventh-day Adventists. So that's the first part of the story. The second part of the story that's so important is I was in Orlando, Florida, and I started my chaplaincy on June 13th, 2016. So if you know dates, the Pulse massacre that happened in Orlando, Florida was on Sunday, June 12th, 2016. So this is, you know, this was not just a incidental happening. This was my club for my community. I am a lesbian, was very familiar with the clubs and the shows that were going on down there in my town. And it was a really awful, awful time. So my first day of chaplaincy, I'm walking in and seeing patients when there are people who were victims of the massacre that are in that hospital system. In addition, you've got everyone around the country, around the world, affected by this and kind of looking at how we are treating our LGBTQ folks. Similar to the awakening that we're seeing with the death of George Floyd, where it's like, wait, this is wrong. And there was also a real reckoning that was happening with reconciling religion and our treatment of the LGBTQ community. So because there were family members that were not picking up their children's bodies, because that's how their children came out, was to die at Pulse. But their religious beliefs were so strong that there were two bodies that were not even picked up because of the homophobia that had been instilled by religion. You know, and it's really notable to say that it was Latin night at Pulse that night. And most of the people were brown or black. And so it was a very intersectional event, but it was very personal. So, and I walked to chaplaincy, right? And my cohort didn't know that I was a lesbian. My supervisor did, but didn't said anything. I was in shock. I was in grief. My church community had activated, the whole church had turned into a counseling center. We had turned it around immediately, opened it up, everyone was bringing water. And I was starting in the hospital and seeing patients. So that context is really everything in this story. The story I wanted to tell you is a visit that I had with a gentleman, and we'll call him Robert. That's not his real name. And I've changed some of the details so it's not too personal, but it's broad enough. And I was about maybe 5 weeks in. Pulse was still there, but it wasn't on the news every day. But it was still very present for folks. And there had already been a lot of conversations of people who wanted to talk to the chaplain because they were watching the news 24/7 and they wanted to reconcile this. And I don't present as gay. And I think there's a lot of people have the assumption that when the chaplain comes into their Seventh-day Adventist hospital room, that they would never occur to them that I was gay. So I was on call overnight and I got a call from the nurses who said, we've got a patient. His name is Robert. He came in with chest pains and shortness of breath. And we've run every test and his heart is fine, but he does not want to go home. He seems very anxious. He says there's unresolved things and he's very worried. And the nurses basically said to me, there's nothing medically that we can do. I think he needs you. And I was like, well, no pressure there. Like, you know, he's got chest pains and all of this. And he's, you know, like, so come on in, chaplain, and can you fix him? And I was like, all right, sure. Great. Wonderful. Okay. So I walk in and he was probably in his mid-60s, white man, kind eyes. And we started talking and he just needed to get some burdens off of his chest. You know, his wife was sick. There was some money concerns. There was, you know, this and this and this and this. And he just started making a whole list. And I could just see this really heavy weight and anxiety on him. So I ran out to the nurse's station and I immediately went in my previous life, I was a brainstorming consultant and I did brainstorming. And I'm like, okay, we need something tangible for this man to let go of. So I ran out to the nurse's station and I asked them for a stack of paper. And I came in and I said, Robert, okay, we're going to write down each one of these, pull them apart. And then my thought is that we can tear each one and you're going to crumple it up and throw it across the room, you know, or I can take them and I can burn them later, turn it into a ritual where he could pull them apart and then release them in some way. And he was like, okay, you know, very confused. Women's ritual was probably not the thing that he was used to. He was raised Catholic and I didn't do anything like that in the Catholic Church. So I was like, okay. And then I was like, well, let's write this down. And he's like, well, I don't want to throw them away because I want to share them with my wife later. I'm like, great. Okay. We're just going to make a list. And we got about halfway through the list and we got into his brother-in-law. And we got that they had loaned the brother-in-law some money. They had done some things that he wasn't quite sure about, had had some challenges about. And he kept going back to the brother-in-law. And I was like, okay, what's going on there? And they had just recently found out that the brother-in-law was gay. And this man was really not struggling with the fact that they had money concerns or that there were trust issues. The more that we dug into it, it was that he was gay and he was disgusted by it. He just couldn't reconcile it. And it was eating him up inside. It was just eating him up. And, you know, I have a little context here where I can say, oh, I recognize this. I know what this is. And I immediately knew that it's like, I was meant to be on call tonight. And I was meant, he came in on the night that I was in call. I didn't have anything else. It was 10 o'clock at night. It's like, let's go here. And in the meantime, he had slowly reached onto my hand. By this point, he was holding my hand and he was squeezing really hard. And I remember it because I had just gotten this brand new engagement ring and I could feel him squeezing my pinky onto the corner of this new ring that it wasn't used to. And it's like there was something there and we kept unpeeling it. eventually he got to the point where he's like, I just, the act of sex disgusts me and I don't know what to do with that. I was like, okay, great. You've named it. Let's explore that. Where does that come from? And we talked more about religion. And by this point, there had already been tears on both of our points and on both of our sides. And he got to a moment, he's like, I think some of it is, I've just never met a gay person before. I don't think in my life I've ever met anyone who was gay. So then I've got a moment there, right? And the thing that you learn about chaplaincy is it is never about you. Like, it's not about me. I am here as a tool and an instrument to help people reconcile their religious things or their trauma of being in the hospital or the pain. But in that moment, I knew that I had an opportunity to have an aha, because this was a man who had already shared some of his deepest things. He had already said, I've never even told my wife these things. He had shared with me things that he had never shared. We had already shed tears together. And he was saying, I've never met anyone gay. And I said, Robert, you actually have. He's like, I just don't think I have. And I held his hand and I said, Robert, I'm gay. And he immediately started crying. And then immediately he felt terrible. He felt so terrible. He's like, I'm so sorry. I am so sorry. I hope that I didn't say anything that offended you. And immediately I was like, no, I was right here with you. We were sharing our hearts and our souls, and I'm sharing because I trust you. And I feel like you trust me. And he just held on. He's like, you are? He's like, you are the most beautiful, caring person I've ever met. I was thinking earlier that you were the angel that came into my hospital room. And I'm like, and I can be. And I can be gay as well. Like, I am gay. And at that point, I showed him my ring and I told him how I had just gotten engaged and that I was madly in love with a woman and that there is way more to our relationship than, you know, just a sexual act or even just a attraction. And you know, we got the chance to talk about how my life and my relationship is so similar to his life and relationship with his wife, and that it's not all about a sexual act. And that if that sexual act is not attractive to you, then that's probably not your sexuality, right? And you don't have to do it. And he just kept crying and he just kept holding my hand. And then I was just checking in on him and how are you feeling? He's like, I feel totally different. Like, my heart doesn't hurt anymore. I've got this list that I can share with my wife. I feel like I put it somewhere and I have changed how I've thought about things. And I could tell he was getting tired. We had been in together for about an hour and a half at that point. He had 4 pages of the list of all of his anxieties that he was going to take home. He couldn't wait to share it with his wife. And I gave him several long hugs and he just was, thank you. And that was it. The next morning I stopped in right before I knew he was going to get discharged and I checked in to see how he was. And he's like, I slept better than I ever have. I feel so great. You are my angel. And can I call you? You know, can I have contact with you because I might need other things? And I said, no, that's actually not how it works. You know, I come into your life here in the hospital and then I release you and you go out and do these things. He's like, but what if I need other people to talk to? And it's like, there are other people. You know, find a minister, find a therapist, there will be other people. But I told him, and I know he knew it, that you will always have a place in my heart, like a deep in redeeming in humanity place. And he had no idea the rest of the story and the stuff that I had gone through and how hard it was to be in a chaplain in that hospital that summer and how the things that were said to me and the way that I wasn't understood or valued as a minister, as a woman, as a lesbian. But in that moment, I knew that I had made that connection, and it was spiritual and deep, and we had shared vulnerability between each other, and it was holy. There is no way else to explain it besides it was holy and sacred, and it changed both of us forever. It has shaped me in a lot of ways, in compassion, understanding, and knowing that we always have room to grow, to know that our stories are tied with our physical self, and that one person's connection with another person can change their life. And he changed mine. And he wanted absolution in a way. And I told him that that's not what kind of minister, like I can't just absolve your brother-in-law, that's not how it works. But together we can struggle with it and look at it. But I think the appointment with Destiny, I think you're right on. Like there's no other chaplain in that hospital that could have done that work. And there is no other patient that would have had that kind of impact on me that summer. So it was a mutual gift.
What's really, I think what's really beautiful about your conversation and encounter with him is that it was completely unexpected. It's not what you thought was going to happen when you were walking in the room. But I also think it's fascinating that your coworkers use the language, he needs you.
Yeah. And that is a testament to the relationship that nurses and chaplains have developed. There definitely is the opportunity and that trust to say, first of all, nurses are the most amazing human beings on earth. And what they do and how they care spiritually and emotionally for people is amazing. So this was a nurse who had a lot of insight and could see that, but who also had definitely, developed relationships with chaplains to know what they did, how they could help.
I think some nurses, if not all of them, are very attuned to sorrow and grief in people. And so can tell when someone needs to just talk and have a conversation and maybe unburden themselves.
I think the thing that was really interesting that I learned over the summer was how to read a room when you walked in. And I believe in energy. I believe in the energy of the mountains and the forests and all of that. And every room looks exactly the same. But when you walk in, you can get the sense whether there is deep grief in there or deep fear or like, oh no, they're fine. And they just want to chat and they want to have a friendly visit or have, some comfort of a prayer that has always been comforting to them. But that sense, you walk in, you have no idea. You don't know what their diagnosis is. You don't know what their mental state is. You don't know what their resources are. You don't know any of that to be able to just respond. And sometimes respond with a face that's not horrified, right? or actions or comments that is like, wait, what? What? I don't know what to do here. But I think, especially in that traumatic summer, I was doubting some of that of, how do humans change things when there is so much heartbreak and devastation and hate and that can just kill 49 people in a nightclub as they're dancing, ironically. Let's bring it back to dancing. And the interaction with Robert made me go, no, it is about interactions with another human being one-on-one. We can change the world by being open and vulnerable and sharing our stories and being open to the possibility that we can impact each other. And that was a reassurance and a reconnecting with my faith that I really needed that summer. It also gave me, confidence that maybe I can do this. You know, maybe I've got enough what it takes to create these magical moments. And I really needed that summer as well. So in a denomination that is very human based, this human interaction was sacred.
What I really love about your story is that there were no grand displays. You weren't ostentatious. You were just quietly authentic. I think, you know, for some people, that's scary because I think a lot of people in this world walk around being what other people want them to be because our society demands that in some ways. And then here you are and you're having a conversation and it's a very vulnerable moment. It's a little bit of a scary moment and you're just there and you're present and you're you. And that's disarming for a lot of people.
He was him too. I knew he was fully in his core place and I was in my core place. You know, we weren't in, neither of us were in an overly like that defeated place, you know, where it's like, oh, you know, I'm just so awful, or in the, you know, inflated place that isn't really real. And it did scare. I mean, don't get me wrong. It was a scary vulnerability. Please don't misinterpret that. It's like, oh yeah. And I just waltzed in there and said, I'm gay. And, you know, rainbows shot out. And, you know, I whipped out my feather boa. Like, you know, it was terrifying. It was terrifying.
That's awesome that they let you carry a feather boa into chaplaincy.
I know. If only, right?
I know, if only.
This has been episode 8 of Bite-Sized Blessings, the podcast all about the magic and spirit that surrounds us, if only we open our eyes to it. And whether you choose to listen to our bite-sized offerings for that 5 to 10 minutes of freedom in your day, or the longer interviews, we're grateful you're here. I need to thank the Reverend Christine Dance for sharing her story today, as well as the creators of the music used, Sasha End, Alexander Nakarada, and Raphael Crux. For complete attribution, please see the Bite-Sized Blessings website at bitesizedblessings.com. And remember, that's bite spelled B-Y-T-E. On the website, you can find links to other episodes, as well as to books and music I think will lift and inspire you. Thank you for listening, and here's my one request. Be like Christine. Be your authentic self, and person by person, change the world.